Okay. The 9th of January.
And I'm talking about the positivistic background of pragmatism. Now, what was I going to say? I was talking about Hume and Kant. Oh, I know. So when Hume and Kant, first proposed this idea that we need to draw a line between what is knowable and what is unknowable, and Tom asked me the question. He says, "Well, shoot, then, because since I had defined positivism as, you know, what we can know scientifically, and what we can't know scientifically, we can't know at all. Since I had defined it that way." Tom asked me the question, well, then where does that leave ethics, right? Mm-hmm. And sure, I can understand that question occurring to somebody because you think to yourself, well, wait a minute now. Ethical questions aren't, you know, exactly scientific questions, right? However, Hume and Kant were, as it were, moderate positivists. And so certainly for them, ethical questions were inside the circle. They did not regard questions of value as something that was unknowable just because it was not. They would say, well, there is a science of morals. They, you know, that's what they endeavored at least to prove. Although I'm not sure that, you know, everybody would follow their or agree with their conclusions. But at any rate, that's how they looked at it. Hume thought that morals could be made into a science in the sense of a science of inner feeling, that he was a moral sense theorist, the idea that we have some sort of emotional response to moral situations which tells us that, well, this is good or this is bad, that sort of thing. And Kant thought that morals was completely a priori. It was just part of being a rational person. We would understand the difference between right and wrong. So Hume and Kant both thought that morals could be brought within the scientific fold and thus would fall inside the circle here. But as I keep on saying, there's positivism and then there's positivism. Like any movement, you're going to have varieties and subspecies and that sort of thing, variations on a theme, I think I said a minute ago. And so you take the logical positivists of the 1930s, which is the form of positivism that I sort of cut my teeth on. When I was a junior in college, but I took a course in contemporary philosophy. And I just fell in love with the positivists, with the logical positivists. I read A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, which is this English language manifesto. It was mostly a German, it was called the Vienna Circle, so German-speaking Austrian movement. But A.J. Ayer was, the only English-speaking member of the Vienna Circle. But anyway, he came back and wrote this manifesto titled Language, Truth, and Logic, which I just loved. You know, I just thought it was the final answer to everything. But anyway, so the logical positivists are over here, this little tiny circle here, because they drew the boundary much, much more narrowly than Hume and Kant had. And their answer to Tom's question would be no. Ethics is not part of anything that we can know, nor is the aesthetics. Any sort of value judgments lie beyond the bounds of sense and are completely unknowable. Ethical propositions, a guy named Charles Stevenson wrote a book called, I think, Ethics and Language, which I also devoured it back in those days. And, he argues for this emotive theory of ethics, that if I say murder is wrong, that's just expressing some sort of emotion. It's nothing that I can really talk about, argue for, anything like that. It's just, I'm just emoting if I say murder is wrong. So in other words, they drew the, and aesthetic judgments, of course, fall into the same category. So they drew the circle, you know, really, really narrowly. And the reason that's important is that when you get to the pragmatists, they're doing the opposite. I mean, this is not a very good circle. You probably can't even see it there on Zoom, but because the purple didn't come through that well. But it's not a very round circle. But at any rate, this is the pragmatist, or I put James up here, because it turns out that the pragmatists went in the other direction. And so their circle is really very capacious and includes a lot of stuff that Hume and Kant would not have included, even. Maybe I should have drawn, I could draw another version of this circle, like here, maybe. And maybe this would be Peirce. So Peirce expands it, certainly, by his pragmatist criterion, this, back in, when he wrote How to Make Our Ideas Clear, which is where this all came from, right? Peirce sort of started the whole business. But Peirce, there are still some things that are excluded by Peirce. Remember the example he gave was transubstantiation. Remember? And he says, is there any practical difference, he says, between a believer in transubstantiation and somebody who believes that the bread and wine are just bread and wine, or in symbols of the body and blood, but not really the body and blood of Christ, right? And Peirce says, no. There's no practical difference between those two positions. But the way William James talks, I don't remember anywhere in anything I've ever read by James where he talks about, I got indices, I could look it up, but I don't remember him talking about transubstantiation. But the way he talks makes it seem as though, indeed, there could be a practical difference between, say, Orthodox Catholic and a Methodist, on the question of transubstantiation. Because James might very well say, it makes a big difference in my life that I believe that the bread and the wine are the actual body and blood of Jesus Christ. That makes a big difference in my life. What do you mean, Peirce, that there's no practical difference? There certainly is a practical difference, see? In which case, the transubstantiation example that Peirce uses would be within the fold. So even within the pragmatist movement, there are differences as to how capacious this circle is going to be. It's so large in the case of William James that you begin to wonder if there's anything at all that falls outside of it. It's almost like positivism undoing itself. Because you expand the circle so much, my goodness, is there anything out there at all that doesn't have a practical consequence? Any belief that doesn't have I can't think of anything. Anyway, so that is the... So we spent many, many weeks, of course. Many, many weeks. I mean, we started back in September, and here it is January. So we spent a lot of time talking about the positivist background to all this, and of course, then also talking about the theory as it's developed in James, and we reviewed especially the work called Pragmatism. That's of the three works that we went over. That is the main one, certainly, for the background to the whole philosophy of religion, Pragmatism, and then. The meaning of truth, and then some problems of philosophy are the three works that we've talked about, but the most important one was the very first, Pragmatism. It's a series of lectures. Yes?
I have a question. Gladys. How was James seen, accepted or rejected among the European philosophers? Skeptics?
Well, there were movements. Remember when we were talking about it was the meaning of truth. There's quite a bit of discussion in there about F.C.S. Schiller, British thinker who called the humanism, but it's kind of the same thing. So there were allies, I guess you could say, okay, in Europe. Obviously... Comteans and people that later flowered into the Vienna circle would not be so enamored of this. Okay. So there was a difference of opinion, certainly. Anything else?
Henri Bergson.
I mean, James likes Bergson. I mean, yeah. James quotes Bergson, actually.
Yes, right, right.
And Bergson, though, is actually, he would certainly be, I guess, you couldn't call Bergson a pragmatist.
Mm-hmm.
But there would probably be a certain amount of consonance, put it that way, between Bergson mm-hmm. and James, I think. I mean, Bergson fits into the European phenomenological tradition very nicely, I think. I really like Bergson a lot. You know, mm-hmm. next year, this coming up semester, I mean, at Ollie, I've been marching through the history of philosophy for 4 years now over there, I think it is. And so I've finally gotten to my last course, and that's post-Kantian philosophy. And so I was thinking, all right, I mean, there's a billion people you could do, of course, but I was thinking to myself, okay, 500 years from now, people looking back, who would they say is, you know, kind of the leading lights? Just like when we look back 500 years, we don't look at all the minutiae unless you're really an expert in that particular, you know, block of history. We just look at the leading lights. So 500 years from now, what are they going to think? And I decided, well, okay, I guess it'll be Hegel, mm-hmm. and then Wittgenstein. So that's what I'm doing in the spring, is Hegel and Wittgenstein. But I was thinking, you know, I would much rather do on the phenomenological, I'd much rather do Henry Bergson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for that matter, I think I'd rather do Karl Popper than Wittgenstein, but, you know, I'm just trying to do assess who would be regarded as the main leading lights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, but that's my guess. Anyway, I'm not looking forward to 5 weeks on Hegel, but there it is. But anyway, getting back to that, so we are now going to embark on the other three. Oddly enough, there are six works of James altogether we're going to be reviewing. And we reviewed three, having to do with the pragmatist epistemology as the background, the theoretical background of what we're doing, of what we're mainly interested in. And now we are embarking on the next three, which are the really famous The Will to Believe, and which, by the way, was written a long time before any of the others. I don't know. I guess there's a date. I don't know if there's a date on it or not. And it really, what it is, hang on.
1880s to 1890s?
There's a preface that is dated 1896. Yeah, it doesn't give a date here, but the preface, at the very end of the preface, mm-hmm. it says December 1896, and the others were in the early 1900s. And that's the one, of course, that Hero talked about a few weeks ago. I don't remember exactly what she said about it. So we're going to do The Will to Believe. We're going to do The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is kind of half philosophical, half psychological, I guess. And then a Pluralistic Universe is the other one that impinges on questions of religion. And I think you'll find all this really interesting. But I think of the three, I think The Will to Believe, in fact, I would say of the six, because I was pretty critical of James's pragmatism and his, because it's so vague, you know. But of the six, I think The Will to Believe is the best of the lot. It's interesting. I'm not sure I agree in all down the line at all with what he says. But it's interesting, and it's worth reading and worth discussing, and I think you'll find it interesting. So this, in a way, is the climax of, I think, the whole study of William James. Although I think you'll find Varieties of Religious Experience interesting, too, but from a different standpoint. But as far as philosophy of religion goes, this is interesting. Let me just say something about the work itself. It is really nothing more than a collection of essays that were sometimes published or I think maybe sometimes talks that were delivered or whatever. But it was, in other words, it's not a continuous work. It's just a collection of other things. And so there's a fair amount of overlap. But if you think about the title, The Will to Believe, raises two ideas, doesn't it? Will and belief. And actually, as you go through these essays, they can be grouped into those two groups. Some of them are more related to the question of religious faith, which is the belief part, and some of them are more relevant to the questions of free will versus determinism and that sort of thing, which is the will part. So, interestingly, there are those two major themes, and you can sort of classify the various essays, under either of those two categories. Let me read you the titles of the so-called chapters or the essays that are part of the Will to Believe. Okay? The first one is titled, guess what? The Will to Believe. So, I mean, the full title of this is The Will to Believe and Other Essays in Popular Philosophy. So, The Will to Believe is actually the very first one in here. But Is Life Worth Living? Is the second one. The Sentiment of Rationality is number three. Reflex Action and Theism is number four. The Dilemma of Determinism, The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life, Great Men and Their Environments, The Importance of Individuals, On Some Hegelisms, and finally, What Psychical Research Has Accomplished. Now, of those 10, I think, essays, let me read you which ones I classify as having to do with belief, the philosophy of religion ones. And I just annotated the table of contents so I could just look at it. Obviously, The Will to Believe, Is Life Worth Living, the Sentiment of Rationality, Reflex Action and Theism, The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life, On Some Hegelisms, and What Psychical Research Has Accomplished. That's seven. That leaves the other three, which are The Dilemma of Determinism, Great Men and Their Environment, and The Importance of Individuals, as on the will half of it. So it's not exactly half and half. It's seven versus three, at least as I see it. Okay. Now, in the religious half of it, or the religious seven-tenths of it, what we find are various arguments for religion, right? When I 3 weeks ago, when I was doing the very last of what I'm calling the theoretical works of James, the pragmatism, problems of philosophy, and problems of philosophy. That was the last one we did. Problems of philosophy. There's an appendix to the problems of philosophy, and I was actually going to talk about the appendix, which is all on religion. Actually, it's about four pages. It's real short, but interestingly, it is a kind of a brief recap of argument number one from The Will to Believe. Which says, I ran out of time, so I didn't get to it. And I was thinking, should I bring it in and go over that? And I thought, no, I won't, because it's just a briefer version of the same thing that we will see in the authoritative place in The Will to Believe. But the interesting thing is, that means, because he didn't get a chance to finish some problems of, well, he probably finished writing it, but maybe didn't get a chance to proofread or, go over it a second or third time. But anyway, what that means is that William James's opinions did not change, is where I'm going with that thought. Since you find basically a sort of a shorter version of that same argument that we're about to embark on in the very last thing that he wrote, that means he didn't change his opinion. So that's of some interest. Anyway, there are five arguments by my lights altogether. And the first one I called the wager argument. And why did I call it the wager argument? Because it's very reminiscent of Pascal's famous wager argument. Pascal, it's kind of a, you might even think of it as a more detailed elaboration of Pascal's wager argument. Pascal's wager argument is, you know, okay, should I believe or not? Well, you know, if my eternal salvation depends on, or the, let me rephrase it, if there's a possibility that my eternal salvation depends on my belief, either I'm right or I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, so what? I don't lose anything. But if I don't believe, and the other was right, then I've lost my chance for eternal salvation. So it's like, that's why they call it the wager argument. It's like placing a bet. I'm placing my bet on, it's a prudent bet. We never know for sure. It's just a prudent bet. Just like, you know, you bet on a lot of things you do, and you, as it were, bet based on, you know, whatever evidence you can gather. It's never a sure thing, but you try to put your bet on the most prudent course of action that you can, you know, figure out. So anyway, the first argument I am calling the wager argument. Let me just tell you what I'm calling them in my notes. And the second one I'm calling the self-fulfillment argument. We'll see how that works. The third I'm calling the volitional argument, which, by the way, has the closest relationship to the pragmatic theory, as we'll see. The fourth one I'm calling the moral argument, and the fifth one I'm calling the, I think I call it the mystical argument, because there's a bit of mysticism coming out in the Will to Believe. So anyway, but let's look first at the wager, what I'm calling the wager argument, okay? So I'm just going to read you some selections here, and as we build the argument and talk about its various little details and how it's developed. He starts off by saying, let us give the name of hypothesis to anything that may be proposed to our belief. Okay, so in other words, what we're talking about are our hypotheses. Right? This is the wager argument. We're never sure exactly how it's going to come out. I can accept the hypothesis of theism, or I can reject the hypothesis of theism. It's not a sure thing. It's a hypothesis. Well, that's what's meant by that word. It's not a sure thing. Okay. Now, let us call the decision between two hypotheses an option. Okay, fine. So now I have the word hypothesis, and I have the word option. Options may be of several kinds. Actually, I should, let me just, I don't need this anymore. So let me get rid of this. I really don't.
Let's place bets as to whether this comes off.
What was that?
So let's place bets as to whether you can erase it.
Oh, I think this side, it works better. What do you think? What's your hypothesis?
Good luck.
Aha! Yeah, there's a difference I've discovered between this board, but this one over here, watch.
Oh. See? You weren't touching that board.
Yes, I was. So, I don't get it. I'm not sure what happened. But if I want to be able to erase it, I got to write it over. If I want it up permanently, I write it over here.
Right.
If I want it temporary, it's over here. All right, this will do. All right. So, options. All right. Where was I now? So, let's see. Okay, we're going to call this decision option. Options may be of several kinds. They may be living or dead. So, living or dead. Forced or avoidable. momentous or trivial? O-U-S, right? Yes. I wrote it as big as I could so that people would be able to see it online. I don't know if you can or not, but it's the best I can do. Okay, so those three, and for our purposes, we may call an option a genuine option when it is of the forced, living, and momentous kind. So, okay, well, that's under this side. So let's just say, tell you what? Genuine. And then, I don't know, non-genuine. How's that? He doesn't give another term. Alrighty. Number one, a living option is one in which both hypotheses are live ones. That's not too much help. If I say to you, be a theosophist or be a Mohammedan is what he means to say, it is probably a dead option. Because for you, I mean, in other words, a dead option for his audience is what he means. He doesn't mean for, like, people in Saudi Arabia, but he means for his audience. It's probably a dead option because for you, neither hypothesis is likely to be alive. So neither hypothesis is likely to be anyone that you're going to wind up worrying about. So it's a dead option for this particular audience. But if I say, be an agnostic or be a Christian, it is otherwise. Trained as you are, each hypothesis makes some appeal, however small, to your belief. Because he's talking to he's writing for address. And this was an address to the philosophical clubs of Yale and Brown Universities in 1896. So he's talking to, obviously, a Christian audience, but one for whom agnosticism is a live option, too. Okay. Number two. Next, if I say to you, choose between going out with your umbrella or without it, I do not offer you a genuine option, for it is not forced. You can easily avoid it by not going out at all. Right. Similarly, if I say, either love me or hate me, either call my theory true or call it false, your option is avoidable. You may remain indifferent to me, neither loving nor hating, and you may decline to offer any judgment as to my theory. So, is my theory true or false? Which is it? And you just don't even answer the question. So it's not a momentous option at all. Forced option. It's a completely avoidable option because I'm just not answering the question. But if I say, either accept this truth or go without it, I put on you a forced option, for there is no standing place outside the alternative. Right? And those are mutually exclusive. In other words, you can't, you know, either tune into a PTR class or don't. There's no possible third alternative there, right? You either do or you don't. So it's a forced option. So this is the same kind of thing.
Eat this soup or don't.
I missed it. What was that again? Soup.
Eat this soup. Or don't.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, once again, two mutually exclusive alternatives. There is no way you can avoid doing one or the other. That's his point, yes. So that's a forced, all these examples, or the latter examples, are examples of forced options. So I put in your fourth option for there's no standing place outside of the alternative. Every dilemma based on a complete logical disjunction, which is what we've been talking about, eat your soup or don't eat your soup. There's no there's no in between there. With no possibility of not choosing is an option of this forced kind. Okay? And number three. Finally, if I were Dr. Nansen, whoever that is, and proposed to you to join my my North Pole expedition, your option would be momentous, for this would probably be your only similar opportunity, and your choice now would either exclude you from the North Pole sort of immortality altogether, or put at least the chance of it into your hands, right? You want maybe be a North Pole immortal, and that's your chance, is to go to the North Pole. He who refuses to embrace a unique opportunity loses the prize as surely as if he tried and failed. Okay? Per contra, the option is trivial when the opportunity is not unique, and when the take is insignificant, or when the decision is reversible if it later prove unwise. Such trivial options abound in scientific life. A chemist finds a hypothesis live enough to spend a year on its verification. He believes it to that extent, but if his experiments prove inconclusive either way, he's quit for his loss of time, no vital harm being done. So that's not, in other words, not a momentous option. There's this theory out there. What was the theory? Oh, it's just a hypothesis. So we don't know what it is. This hypothesis out there. He does some experiments. They're just inconclusive. Can't confirm the hypothesis. Can't exactly disconfirm it. It just doesn't seem to be leading anywhere. So we move on to other things. Yeah, I've lost some time, but it's not a momentous thing. I haven't lost my job or anything like that. It's not like losing the chance to become a North Pole immortal by joining the North Pole expedition, right? See, that's the difference there. Okay, so far? So three contrasts, three kinds of, well, six altogether, kinds of options, I suppose you'd say. Okay, now there's another contrast coming up.
Hey, Don, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So the momentous one is meaning you think it's momentous or trivial at the time you make it. Because, you know, let's just take a trivial example. Whether I got online today or drove to church,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a trivial decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if I got in an accident on the way to class today,
yeah.
you know, that it could turn out to be momentous. But
yeah.
it's really at the time of when you're thinking, not the actual result, right?
That's an interesting distinction. Yeah, I think that's what he's thinking, though. Yeah. I think it would have to be because go ahead, Jay.
Also, it could be that the scientist who is diverted from the hypothesis
right.
because he failed with it, that could be momentous, and that he devotes his time to the hypothesis that might work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don, can you repeat what Jay said, please?
Yeah, Jay just said, well, the scientist who went down this rabbit hole and got nowhere, it could turn out, and this is kind of following up on Tom's point, it could turn out to be more momentous because he now has not been able to investigate something else that really was earth-shaking, perhaps, or something like that, maybe, or whatever. Yes, Gladys.
I see it as the option is the initial thought of the option of being able to go to the go to North Pole. It is momentous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's why the scientist did the same. He thought this could be momentous, otherwise he would not be investing all the time. And well, it didn't pan out at the end, but that's beside the point. Originally, he thought it would have been a momentous opportunity something.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess what James is thinking is, but the scientists would have factored in the possibility that this might not go anywhere. Do I really want to invest the time or not? And So it's not that you wouldn't, if the scientists had foreseen a huge loss, you know, if it didn't work out, then you'd have second thoughts about even embarking on it. So that, but I mean, going back to Tom's original question, I think the consensus is, as Tom suggested, it's at the time of the decision, because right. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about now,
right.
You know, our assessment now of what's likely to happen or what have you, because that's what he's talking about. He's talking about making a decision between alternative hypotheses. So it's what whatever evidence I have right now that is relevant. But that's a good point, Tom, because it helps clarify what's going on. Yeah. There's another distinction going on here, too. Let's read the second distinction. There are two ways of looking at our duty in the matter of opinion. Ways entirely different, and yet ways about whose difference the theory of knowledge seems hitherto to have shown very little concern. We must know the truth, and we must avoid error. Two things to consider: knowing the truth and avoiding error. Which is uppermost in your mind, is the question he's asking here. Yeah. These are our first and great commandments as would-be knowers, but they are not two ways of stating an identical commandment. They are two separate laws. We need to pursue truth, and we need to avoid error. Two different concerns. Okay. Believe truth, shun error. These, we see, are two materially different laws, and by choosing between them, we may end by coloring differently our whole intellectual life. We may regard the chase for truth as paramount and the avoidance of error as secondary. Or we may, on the other hand, treat the avoidance of error as more imperative and let truth take its chance. That's an interesting distinction. In other words, which are you more focused on? Which are you most... You know, there was this guy... what was his first name? I keep on thinking Clark, but it's not Clark Clifford. Yeah. But it's a guy whose last name is Clifford. I wonder if in the table of contents they... Because I don't remember his first name. But he was... Let's see. No, it didn't say. Well, anyway, I could look it up.
Showing your age with Clark Gifford there, Don.
Clifford, yeah, I know. Well, yeah, he goes back to... Where does he go back to? I don't know.
LBJ.
That far back?
I think so.
You know, I think he lived in Bethesda. I think he lived on Rockville Pike. I think. Just past NIH as you're going out toward Rockville, I think. Well, anyway, that's neither here nor there. But Clifford, not Clark Clifford, but the other Clifford, was notorious. And I should have brought in the quote. I don't remember it exactly, but it's something like, it is wrong always and everywhere to believe anything on insufficient evidence. as though this was a cardinal sin, you know, to ever believe something on insufficient evidence. Clearly, that then is an extreme statement that your paramount duty in life is to avoid error.
All right.
But
you're not going to leave.
I'm going to be really careful. Yeah, I'm going to be really careful never to commit myself to anything that's in any way even remotely shaky, because I want to make sure I don't make any mistakes. Which is going to lead me, of course, to draw this circle.
Smaller and smaller.
Really small.
Yeah.
You know, unless it can be completely corroborated, I'm not going to commit myself. Right? Obviously, that's going to work out in an agnostic direction.
What kind of life you're going to have if you're going to be afraid of everything?
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm not going to commit myself to something like religion, because that's too iffy, right? I mean, William James is by no means saying, unlike, say, Thomas Aquinas, that many of these propositions can be demonstrated. He absolutely cheerfully agrees that, no, we can't demonstrate these things. But the question is, are you going to approach life with the promise to yourself that I'm going to do everything possible to avoid making? It's like investing, right? When you talk to your investment advisor or whatever, they are always going to ask you, okay, what amount of risk are you willing to accept? If you have a very low tolerance of risk, you're going to invest in bonds, I guess, right? That's pretty safe. Not a high yield, but probably you'll get to keep your money. But if you have a lot of tolerance of risk, you're going to throw it all in stocks and, you know, maybe even venture capital type things where it could come out great, but it could be a disaster, right? Mm-hmm. It's a question of tolerance of risk. It really is a lot like that. Mm-hmm. So the religious person then is going to have is going to be on the seeking truth side more and less on the avoidance of error side, whereas non-Clark Clifford is going to be more on the avoidance of error side than the seeking of truth side. It's partly a matter of personality, even, I guess. But that's the crucial distinction. Now, what's coming up, and I don't think I have time for it, because I only have 1 minute left, but what's coming up are three sections. I read that. Are three sections. That was from section 7. But 8, 9, and 10 are respectively on science, morality, and religion. And what he's doing in 8, 9, and 10... Let me write up on the board also. I'll do it in green. This other distinction... no good. Let's see about this one. Oh, this is a good one. Seeking truth versus, I want to draw a line here because this is not part of the previous thing, avoiding error. Okay, so that's our, so this entire taxonomy or analysis, I guess, of options, there are two sets of distinctions. This one right here, the genuine versus the non-genuine, and down here, another one, seeking truth versus avoiding error. So what's coming up is a discussion of science, of morality, and of religion in terms of these two sets of distinctions. See what I mean? It's really pretty interesting. But we're out of time, so we will finish argument number one next time and then move on and see how far we get for the other arguments.
Thank you.
Alrighty? Thanks. Hopefully we'll be more in class next time. That, you know, we won't have these weather threats, but you never know. It is winter. Alright. See you guys.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Don. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye. Okay. Oh, let me turn this off.